I just came back from upstate New York. It was my first getaway to upstate New York. We'd rented a little cabin where it's kind of not really a cabin. It's just like this little attachment to a house that overlooks this insane view. It's up in the Catskills, so it's like at the top of a mountain, and it has this insane view of the sunset and stuff. And the people that live there are so cute. They take you on hikes and stuff like that. But I really was up there and I was like, wow, am I a country girl? Do I need to leave the city? And then I came back to the city and I was like, I feel spiritually decrepit.
In the city?
In the city, yes. I'm just like, I think I'm feeling a bit fatigued with the city. It's just like nonstop noise. And I mean, of course, I grew up in a city, but New York is much louder than Toronto is, and my neighborhood is especially much louder than Toronto is. It's very noisy. It was just so nice to be around like green. My neighborhood has very little trees, and it just felt so good to be like, wow, I'm surrounded by nature, I'm surrounded by trees. I didn't really grow up being an outdoorsy girl, but I think like the older I get, the more attracted to the outdoors I am. I do kind of want to go camping these days, and I wonder if part of that is just getting older. I'm now at this age where I'm like, when I travel now, I don't really want to go travel to like a city. I've done the city, and now I just want to go somewhere that's extreme R&R. And I'm like, what does this say about me? Have I aged? But it was so nice to just be somewhere where you could just simply hear the birds chirping and you could see the stars.
I totally get that. I get the appeal. I think I love kind of settling in that when I know that there's an end date of me being retreated in the country. But I think long term, the social element of country living, I think I just simply couldn't do it. But I do love nature.
No, and I totally get that too. I mean, we're at the age where maybe like starting to think about the concept of raising a family and like what that would look like. And I've just been thinking more and more about how important it is to have people around you. If you were to have a kid, people who can help out, people who the kid knows, adults that the kid knows, other kids that the kids knows that aren't just like from school, like cousins, for example. And that started to be kind of a factor in my life. So yeah, I do think living somewhere more isolated would be difficult with that. Although I do think that rural communities are actually somehow more interconnected and communal than the city is. Once again, my neighbors, new neighbors moved in and I said hi to them on the stairs and they simply just blinked at me. And I was like, what? Like, are you guys allergic to politeness? Like, I don't understand what's going on here.
They were like confused that you would talk to them.
They're like stranger dangering me or something. I'm like, what? I just want to talk to you. Like, I just literally want to have a conversation and foster community. But then again, I don't know if I want to foster community with a bunch of 23-year-olds, I guess. I guess this is me being like, whatever, you're just a dumb bitch anyway. Oh, you don't want to talk to me? Well, you're stupid. But yeah, no, it was so, upstate is gorgeous.
I was thinking about this a lot. I've realized recently that cities have rhythms and places have rhythms. And it's kind of interesting once you become like used to noise and like busyness and whatever movement, it's, I think, hard to adjust to new places. And I think you kind of, but also sometimes when you do find yourself in the country, you just forget what silence actually sounds like. Mm-hmm. And that can be very nice.
It's just healing. It feels extremely healing. Okay, I know this is insane because I just moved to New York. I obviously love the city. It's insanely, absurdly beautiful. Driving in on like the George Washington Bridge, you're like, oh my God, this is stunningly gorgeous. But you just feel so, I don't know how to explain it, but yeah, being outside of the city, being in like a rural setting, you feel extremely connected to yourself, I guess. Like, I just felt extremely connected to my soul. Or I was also in a place of like no thoughts, you know, which felt good. Obviously, I think your feelings about the city are also reflective of how you're feeling generally. I've just, you know, maybe haven't been having the best few months. So I associate the city, or I project those feelings onto the city when in fact it is me or my problems. And I'm sure that if things start getting better, I would be like, oh, I love New York. I'm probably just in like a bit of a growing pains era right now, as anyone would be, I guess, moving somewhere new. But
yeah, you're in that first year slump, I think. And also, like, I think it's fair to love New York and want to be in New York, but also not love it all the time. I think it's a city like that, your relationship is going to be tumultuous. It's going to be a bit problematic. It's going to be up and down.
Yeah. And you know what? Okay, well, I say that, oh, blah, 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 it's me and not the city. But you know what the actual problem is?
What?
The real enemy here? Motorcycles.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Get your fucking, I swear to God, if someone, when someone drives a motorcycle by me on the street, I become homicidal. Like, I truly am like, what possessed you to bring such disruption into the world? Only a man, first of all. Of course, most of them are men because they're so destructive. And loud and noisy, but it's just like, why? What possessed you to do this? And what possessed you to harm this environment in this way? And you get to fart across the street on your motorcycle as loud as humanly possible. I have to live with that noise. I did not consent to you riding that motorcycle beside me like that. And so, yeah, maybe the real problem here is motorcycles, and that in the countryside, I don't really hear them as much.
And I think a world without motorcycles is a better world, no matter where you are.
I completely agree.
Maybe on that Zoran note, will get rid of motorcycles.
And you know, yeah. Zoran honestly would. And you know what people sit on motorcycles with?
They're fat BBLs.
They're fat asses. So on that note, I'm Maya.
And I'm Hannah.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is about beauty on the internet. Social media may have snatched our faces, but has it also snatched our souls? If you like our show and you want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes, a whole back catalog of mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. If you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps us out a lot. In 2011, Kim Kardashian stood before the reality TV cameras of Keeping Up with the Kardashians and smugly pointed to a scan of her ass. Shortly after the episode aired, Khloe Kardashian tweeted, "See? It's real!" With Kim responding, "Haha, the things my sisters have me do. Proof, baby." The world was stunned. How was it that Kimberly Kardashian, reality TV princess, could be equipped with such a dumpy? Certainly she was not naturally blessed with what today called certified Armenian meat. It just couldn't be so.
I'm sorry, certified Armenian meat?
Kim was characteristically silent about what was likely really going on, but even back in 2011, and even more in the years following, the answer was on people's tongues. Three letters. B-B-L. Now, in our Kim K Breaks the Internet episode, Hannah talked pretty extensively about the Kardashians and their alleged putting of the booty on the proverbial map, Kim appearing nude and ass first on the cover of a wildly viral issue of Paper Magazine kicked off a whole discussion about the era of the big booty, helmed by our particularly stupid Vogue article, which cited Kim and Miley Cyrus as instigators of the trend, which was then quickly followed up by a counter discussion about the culture co-opting traits natural to Black women that had been demonized and mocked for years, only now seen to have value because they were appearing on the bodies of white women. Since we've already trodden that ground, this episode will take a slightly different approach to the BBL as a procedure, both its somewhat dark history and its specific present-day application. Hannah, please tell us, what is a BBL?
A BBL is a procedure where I believe the fat from one's like stomach or like torso is taken out and put into their ass. Is that correct? To give them a large butt?
That is somewhat correct, yes. I think that is mostly correct. So gluteal fat grafting, which has been colloquially termed the Brazilian butt lift, or BBL, is a two-step procedure which begins, yes, with liposuction of fat from an area of the body. So usually the abdomen, the thighs, the back, or the flanks, so the lower back, and then injection of that fat into the hips or buttocks to make it larger and more protruding. When and where did you first learn about the BBL? This is a multi-part question, so please pay attention. Pay attention. What is that quote from?
Pay attention?
Yeah.
I can't say.
Is it Teresa Giudice?
Teresa Giudice is prostitution whore.
Prostitution whore. Oh, no, it's the woman who she's yelling at whose name I can't remember. She's like, pay attention. And then Teresa's finger is like lingering in the air pointing at her with her mouth like agape. Anyways, pay attention. When and where did you first learn about the BBL? Have you seen these dumpies in the wild? And since transparency is hot these days, please be honest with the listeners. Do you have one?
Wow. Wow. I've actually never been asked like more thoughtful questions in my life, frankly. Let's see. The first time I heard of a BBL, I must have been around 2019 or something. I feel like when we were really just talking a lot about plastic surgery, suddenly it was becoming apparent that people's asses weren't natural. And I think, I don't know, I think there's maybe a period where we were like celebrating naturally fat asses. And then because there was a while when no one wanted a butt. And then once we started doing that, then people started getting more BBLs, I imagine. And so I can't be sure when I first heard of one. Have I ever seen one in the wild? Well, yes. If you take a walk down King Street West in Toronto, you will see many a BBL in many a spandex pant. And I, for the longest time, like, I'm not the most observant girly in the world. So sometimes, like, I wasn't really, like, noticing it. And then someone pointed out to me how common they are. It was probably you. And how easy they are to spot. And now it is quite fun to go, okay, well, there is a BBL, but maybe, I don't know, BBLs are something that I think are more popular amongst a type of baddie, like a girly that like we don't usually hang out with. So like, I don't think I've ever hung out with someone with a BBL, although like I'm always trying to expand my friend group. Now, do I have a BBL? No, not yet. But, you know, who knows where the future is going to take us? I'm in a stage of metamorphosis, and will that, you know, translate to my ass? Who knows?
It's gonna go right down to the ass. I just know it. Yeah. Someone recently asked me, like, they're like, why does Toronto want to be LA so bad? And I was like, yeah, that is a good point, because the prevalence of absurd filler and BBLs in Toronto and spandex, which is just like horrible, like, The Toronto spandex takeover has just been brutal. The athleisure takeover, you just don't see that as much in New York. And I don't know, I actually couldn't tell you an area where I think I would see that. This kind of hyper LA, like we have like a wellness strip in Toronto, which we definitely do in like Williamsburg here, but it's just a bit different. I don't know what it is.
I think the beautiful thing about Toronto is that it takes some of the worst parts of LA and New York, but like gives you like the Shein version and then like puts them in a blender and makes a city. And that's how I would describe young people in downtown Toronto. They either wish they were in the Lower East Side or they wish they were like shopping on Melrose or something.
Yeah. It's so, so real and true. Yeah. And I think like the wanting the BBL, the worshipping of the natural fat ass kind of had a short shelf life because it came with this concept of, oh, a naturally fat ass would also come with naturally bigger thighs and cellulite. And so, of course, we were like, well, we got to get rid of those. And so a BBL kind of offers this type of ass that doesn't have, like, you could still have skinny little thighs and no cellulite, you know, and that's, It's a weird look, which we'll get into, but people mm-hmm. like it. So in the US alone, the number of BBLs that had been performed between 2015 and 2019 increased by 103%. It became almost commonplace for people, mostly women, to fly to Turkey, Mexico, Thailand to get BBLs for as cheap as $3,000 a pop, where in the States it could be double or more when you factor in the cost of aftercare and whatnot. In the US, South Florida is the largest hub for the procedure, which I guess isn't really shocking. Miami core. So by 2021, the BBL was the fastest growing cosmetic procedure in the world. It was also the one with the highest mortality rate. In 2017, the chances of dying from complications related to luteal fat grafting was 1 in 3,000, which is alarmingly high for something cosmetic. Thankfully, in the years since, there's been more innovation and education in this regard. So the mortality rate has lowered to 1 in 20,000, which is, you know, a pretty big decline, but it's still higher than the mortality rate for regular liposuction, let's say, which is now 1 in 50,000, but also had a mortality spike when it was popularized back in the 90s. Kanye West's mother was a victim of this type of procedure. So the main reason that the mortality rate is so high is because of improper technique. Basically, your ass has a lot of large blood vessels in it, which if a surgeon were to inject them with fat by accident, the fat can travel to your lungs and cause a pulmonary embolism, which can kill you. Usually they should be very sparing with the amount of fat that they insert, but I'm sure as you've seen from the dumpies that are prevalent online, this often isn't the case. Hannah, can you imagine why in the world surgeons would be playing so fast and loose with their technique?
I feel like it always goes down to money. I also think that perhaps because cosmetic procedures are like sort of taboo and people kind of will maybe go to less reputable places to in order to like save money, or people are like less open about it, that like maybe there's, I have no idea, this is speculation, like maybe there's less of a sort of in medical integrity that's like expected of plastic surgeons. Or maybe I'm wrong, maybe it's the opposite.
No, that is interesting. I mean, there are a few factors. One of them definitely is just like them being money grubbers. But yeah, in like cheaper places, they found that the demand is so high that these clinics are pumping out these procedures at much higher rates. So they're less discerning about which patients may not be the appropriate candidates for a BBL. One doctor in this article for Vox said that about 30% of the patients who come to him aren't appropriate for the procedure. Also in the US, and this, let's put a huge asterisk on this because I read this from that same Vox article, but I did have trouble kind of verifying the specificity of this claim. I tried to check in with my friend who's in med school, but she was a bit confused. She's been mostly studying in Canada, so it was hard for her to corroborate it. But basically, I was reading that the field of medicine in the US is largely self-policed, which makes it difficult to regulate. Apparently, in every state, every single state, this article said, medical doctors are allowed to practice and treat patients in any field as long as they obtain that patient's consent. So they were saying that a plastic surgeon could perform cardiac surgery out of their office if they wanted to, and only be charged a civil penalty for malpractice as opposed to a criminal one, which means that there are people out there performing luteal fat grafting surgery who are trained in other fields of medicine altogether.
Fabulous.
Fabulous. Also, have you seen, have you seen those plastic surgeons who are famous on TikTok?
I've seen videos of people, plastic surgeons, who talk about like, oh, this person has this, this person is that, this person like should have this, or like speculating about like what people have had procedures.
These guys who have like hundreds of thousands of followers on TikTok who kind of made a name for themselves promoting plastic surgery in this kind of meme format as something that's socially necessary and also fun. They're kind of funny guys. I fucking hate them. Like, I think they're the scourge of our society, truly, but they're there. And a lot of BBL content was coming from these guys around like the peak of the BBL, who were providing little to no information about the possible risks or even just basic aftercare for the procedure. And aftercare is super extensive. You have to sleep on your stomach for at least 6 weeks. Whenever you sit, it has to be on a special pillow. You have to get frequent painful post-op massages, and you have to wear this corset type thing called a faja at all times, because basically your new fat is training itself to connect with your old fat. So gross. I know.
I hate that.
It's so, there's something so macabre about it in a way that I'm just like, how is this aspirational? It's like so scary.
As a deeply squeamish girl, I really, really hate that.
Yeah, yuckies. When I was researching, I came across an article by the American Board of Plastic Surgeons, which was trying to debunk various misinformation about the Brazilian butt lift. And they said that despite its name, it isn't Brazilian. I'm not sure why they said that, but they are wrong. And here is why. So a little bit of history. This is where I'm going to talk a bunch, but like, feel free to interject whenever. Brazil is a super diverse country, and it has the largest population of African descended people outside of Africa. This is, of course, because they were brought over by the Portuguese as enslaved people during the transatlantic slave trade. When slavery was abolished in Brazil in 1888, there was a goal among the white settlers to create a white nation, but they were vastly outnumbered by the recently liberated black population. So then comes along a eugenicist named Renato Kahle, who put forth this idea that blackness could be slowly diluted over time and eventually erased through different state-sanctioned eugenics initiatives. So racist policies played out pretty differently in Brazil than, say, in the US, which had been implementing segregationist policies like actual segregation, criminalizing miscegenation as a way to preserve whiteness. Instead, in Brazil, miscegenation was actually encouraged. Miscegenation is interracial couplings, marriages, which obviously took on a less overtly racist tone over the years, and instead in the 20th century was rebranded as a way for Brazil to move towards being a post-racial society. But racism was still very much underscoring the sentiment here. Kahle was also a big proponent of plastic surgery, which he viewed to be, quote, the cure to ugliness. Ugliness here being code for blackness.
Right.
It's bad. The focus was placed on improving people's bodies to achieve a whiter standard of beauty. I wanted to ask, though, given that eugenics is so preoccupied with this concept of, like, selective reproduction, I do think it's kind of contradictory that they'd support a practice that isn't going to affect what your progeny looks like. It's like the way that everyone talks about how Kylie Jenner's kids are going to look like what Kylie Jenner used to look like instead of what she looks like now kind of deal. Mm-hmm. What do you, like, why do you think they'd be promoting plastic surgery if the goal was to, like, dilute racialized features over time?
I mean, there's something about plastic surgery that I think in cultures where it becomes more commonplace, there are some cultures where, like, plastic surgery is something that, like, people do generationally, which I guess, like, doesn't necessarily, like, change the gene pool, but...
Well, yeah, and still being ethnic, like, you're still being born into an ethnic... a society that, you know, might be discriminatory towards your ethnicity, so maybe you'd be compelled in that way by having that handed down in various ways. Yeah, I do think it's this idea of giving... I think I agree also with what you said about intergenerationally being handed down, just because, like, yeah, you're still being born into a racist society. I do also think it's this idea of giving, like, a short-term fix to what they saw to be a societal flaw. Maybe this idea of creating a homogenized look for the country in the meantime. Mm-hmm. Brazil has an incredibly overrepresented working class population, and class hierarchies in Brazil are very harshly defined. So beauty there is explicitly tied to social status. There's a Brazilian phrase called gente bonita, beautiful people, which is used as a euphemism for light-skinned people, which is then a euphemism, obviously, for being higher class and having social capital. On the other hand, the phrase pobre, preto, e feio, I'm sorry, I don't speak Portuguese. We're anglicizing these words, which means poor, black, and ugly, is used as a pejorative. There's also a phrase, a beleza abre portas, I'm sorry, which means beauty opens doors. We obviously know that this is the case in our own society here in the West. Like, of course, you know, whatever, if we want to talk about pretty privilege, that is a thing. But in Brazil, it's very literal. For example, there was this famous story that people dubbed O Mendigo Gato, the handsome beggar, which was where a photo of a 30-year-old man who had been begging on the streets was posted to Facebook and then went viral because he was light-skinned and had blue eyes. This led to a media frenzy where the public came together to lift him out of poverty, and outlets were, like, documenting his rehabilitation purely because they were like, he's too pretty to be poor. Whereas, like, I don't know necessarily if you'd see that as explicitly in the States. Like, of course, maybe people...
There's Hot Felon. Does he count?
Hot Felon, yeah. But it feels like there was a full community effort, basically, a nationwide effort to lift this guy out of poverty in a way that in the States, like, huh, that's interesting, you know? And I think a lot of it does have to do with this, like, oh my God, he has these, like, Eurocentric features. There's, like, a video about it, and all the comments are from these Brazilians being like, this is so Brazil, you know, to like, select this man out of all of our impoverished people and make him have money, or, like, give him money because he just simply looks good in their eyes.
I guess that's, like, technically what the model, like, the modeling industry is the only place where you usually see that, which is, like,
well,
obviously,
and guess,
a lot of people use it, yeah.
And guess where recruiters go so often? Where's Brazil. Gisele Bündchen from? Brazil. And, like, what does she look like? German.
Yes. Know? Well, her name also is very German.
Yes, exactly. But it's like the modeling industry will kind of, like, pluck these people out of obscurity who are just, like, extremely Eurocentric. And they're like, how do we find this diamond in the rough, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Guys, the holidays are just around the corner. Personally, I like to get my shopping done early. The only problem is I'm always holding out for the perfect gift, which isn't always easy to find. Luckily for me and my loved ones, Quince has me covered. With Quince, you can find luxurious gifts like cashmere sweaters or Italian wool jackets for super reasonable prices. Hannah told me she's never felt fancier than when she puts on her new Mongolian cashmere sweater from Quince, and she loves to see the shock on people's faces when she tells them it was only $50. Plus, her fingers are going to stay nice and toasty all winter long thanks to her beautiful shearling gloves. And if you thought Quince was only looking out for the fashion girlies, you thought wrong. Quince has gifting options for everyone in your life, from the home cooks to the world travelers. I, for one, have been cooking up a storm in my stainless steel sauté pan, which I bought after having a freak out about nonstick, but that's a story for another time. Find gifts so good you'll want to keep them with Quince. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash. Being moody doesn't have to be a bad thing. Sometimes it can be fun to lean into how we're feeling by surrounding ourselves with things that match that feeling. Our moods play a big role in our choice of music, food, even lighting. So why not extend that logic to cannabis products? This is possible thanks to our sponsor, Mood, an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC products right to your door. Gummies that only get you high? That's so passé. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. And with our promo code REHASH, you can get 20% off your first order at mood.com. Whether that's mind magic gummies for deep work and creativity, sleepy time to get you settled for a restful night, or chill out for some needed relaxation. THC gummies are everywhere these days, so why not go with a brand that lets you customize your experience? Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. The best part is, Mood ships directly and discreetly to your door. That means no more waiting in dispensary lines, and no risk of an awkward run-in with your mom's friend Mary. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code REHASH. So head to mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code REHASH when you check out to save 20% off your first order. I was reading an article called The Biopolitics of Beauty, Cosmetic Citizenship and Affective Capital in Brazil, which talks about this instance of the handsome beggar, where they say something that reminds me a lot of what we talked about in the looks maxing episode about beauty and wealth. They say, magical thinking is becoming a common characteristic of late capitalism because the economic promise of upward mobility is fragile and precarious, leading people to put their faith in non-economic means of advancement. So in the article, they interview Brazilians who thought of beautification like plastic surgery, not so much in terms of vanity or even beauty itself, but as a means for social mobility explicitly. And of course, beauty is like inextricable in this context from race. So I could see how plastic surgery would provide this immediate solution to tangible problems like social welfare if that is the currency it holds in Brazilian culture. Beauty will lift you out of poverty is the thinking here. So like, why not try to ascend out of my class status? And of course that exists here, but this is like in a very explicit sense. Because of this, plastic surgeons are positioned in the Brazilian society as heroes and healers because they have this power to exact that kind of magical thinking we talked about. The power to make someone beautiful and by virtue of that, potentially ascend their economic status. Plastic surgery in Brazil was slowly expanded into the country's healthcare system, making it more accessible or in some cases free for working class Brazilians. What do you think of that? Like, do you think plastic surgery should be like democratized?
Well, I think it kind of mirrors to like a more extreme extent this pragmatic approach to cosmetic procedures that we've also kind of got going on now in North America, where whether or not we are willing to like say it out loud in such a way, like there is just a very, there's like a, it's like pretty clear that like looks actually do play like a huge role in your social mobility, your economic mobility, like your ability to get a job or to attract people or to get into the right rooms. Like looks matter. And I think a lot of people do use that as reasons why they get plastic surgery, where they're, yes, we can talk about ethics, we can talk about whatever, but ultimately I'm trying to better my life. Even something like the, you know, the story of Anna Nicole Smith. It's like she got a boob job so that she could work and make proper money as a stripper. It was like an investment economically. Mm-hmm. And it for a step. And obviously she was working in a field where your breasts are like part of the job, but I do think that we see that mirrored in other places as well. I think it's very interesting to see it kind of to just be like admitted outright that a culture like values that, but I think it's probably just more subtextual but still very present in like North American society as well.
For sure. Yeah, no, it is extremely present here,
but is a crazy idea. Yeah,
the saying out loud part and like the state implementation part is so fascinating to me. So there was this one surgeon in the 20th century who became the most highly regarded healer of his time. His name was Ivo Pitanguy, and he became famous in the 60s for pushing for plastic surgery to be made available to the poor, and became the first to open a clinic to low-income patients in a philanthropic Catholic hospital in Rio de Janeiro. You would talk about like Mother Teresa in this way, you know what I mean? Like it's fascinating that it's like a plastic surgeon. He was also the first person to pioneer the Brazilian butt lift.
Oh.
Yes.
So wait, the Brazilian butt lift is also a Catholic invention?
Maybe. Well, those priests
they care about the aesthetics.
We got the good, those nuns got the dumpies under their habits or whatever they wear. Thinking about the ways that beauty can be sanctioned by the state in the way that it has been in Brazil, there's this amazing writer and scholar named Mimi Tai Nguyen who speaks directly to this in her book, The Promise of Beauty, where she says, "The presence of beauty might be secured through biopower, bringing together the disciplinary power operating on bodies with the exercise of power over populations, especially in their shared capacity to make live. Recruited as physical fitness, emotional well-being, or cultural competency, beauty might be directed at purposes as specific as eliminating welfare dependency and as comprehensive as nurturing whole personhood." Biopower being the idea that beauty can be like a powerful tool for top-down control, and we've seen how that plays out with plastic surgery in Brazil and its eugenics origins. But why is Brazil so obsessed with the butt? What on earth would a big butt have to do with eugenics? Especially considering its pursuit of Eurocentric features. Like, why are we retaining the bum?
Perhaps like hips indicate a reproductive quality, birthing hips.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Except they're not really birthing hips because they're fake.
Well, exactly. But it like signifies that, I guess. That's the ideal.
Okay.
So during the time where these pro-miscegenation policies were being put into place or pervading Brazilian culture in the mid-20th century, an emblem of this ideal post-racial society emerged in the form of a hypersexualized mixed-race woman known in Brazil as the mulata. She is typically lighter-skinned with Eurocentric features, but also very bodacious. The Biopolitics article talks about the ways that the mulata became the subject of a Brazilian national myth of post-racial reproduction, of course underpinned by those elements of eugenics. And I think her bodaciousness and hypersexuality is meant to amplify this ideal of fertility, propagating an ultimately white body politic. There's even a wildly popular contest called Miss Bum Bum that happens every year in Brazil, where 27 women compete for the title of the best butt in the country. Usually the contestants are bodacious and light-skinned, or full on white, again, despite the country's large black population. So researching all of this, I kept thinking about how it was so strange that the BBL would translate so seamlessly from Brazil to the US, considering how very different these cultures are. We've kind of touched a bit on like how the US is a bit more subtextual, but I did want to pose this question to you. Like, why do you think the BBL specifically transferred so easily into American culture, even though it's so seemingly different from Brazil? Because when we think about Brazil, we're like, oh, it's like dancing. It's a different vibe that maybe it's been ingrained, but we're like, oh yeah, bodaciousness being the overall trend. But like America being founded upon this like waspish ideal and like these more puritanical concepts, like it's interesting to me that the butt would become so popular there.
I think because by the time the BBL picked up, I think that like waspishness had fully gone out of fashion. And I think, you know, it is that thing of like a lot of white culture wanting to absorb black culture, a lot of sort of, you know, fetishizing of like black body parts, but also, you know, white women then like taking it on for themselves. And sort of, I think that it makes a lot of sense that it would translate to the States, because like perhaps like some of the cultural artifacts going on are different, but the prominence of hip hop, especially in that era, like the prominence of certain stars who like embraced their bodies, I think it just does make sense that that would make it a desirable trait. I mean, we just turned the ass into such a cultural phenomenon. It was the ass era. It's kind of interesting to think of a singular body part having such a strong grasp on the culture.
No, yeah, I think blackness having social currency in the States with its own, you know, marred history and like relationship with the black community, which was obviously quite different than Brazil's, but also the way that the black community kind of came up through these popular media outlets, and like the way that blackness has always kind of been on the forefront of popular culture but then always robbed of its credit, I think that makes a lot of sense that it had a lot of specific social currency in the States as well. I also think in the past few years Brazil is up in the West in general. There's this whole episode of Nymphet alumni where they talk about Global South Core And I've just been mulling over why the aesthetics of these countries are so en vogue in the West right now. You know, the Brazil jersey, Brazil bikinis, Brazil, like, booty shorts are such a thing, or, like, really had their moment. And I think given the fact that the West became allegedly less segregationist, has undertaken these very liberal representational politics of multiculturalism, or in the US specifically, melting pot multiculturalism, I could see how that, like, post-racial Miss Bum Bum ideal would begin to take on new importance over time, because it represents that very cherry-picked, superficial notion of racial harmony, but with racism still at its core. I you know, if we were to look at, you know, the way that paleness once had a currency among the elite, and now it's being as bronzed as possible, you know, like that aspect of racial ambiguity becoming more of a thing. Yeah, you also mentioned, like, you know, these pop culture figures embracing their own bodies. And yeah, I do think that we see over the past few decades, like, a new beauty ideal emerge in the US, almost top down. Like, we have voluptuous, racialized, light-skinned women like Halle Berry and Jennifer Lopez becoming the new sex symbols for America. And with that, we see, like, other female celebrities like Kim Kardashian and Ariana Grande, women who don't necessarily have those features naturally, attempt to emulate that standard. Mm-hmm. Lest we forget Ariana's mixed girl era. Never forget. What do they call her? Africana Grande. I do think that the very conspicuous hypersexuality of having a big butt is interesting, though, in a more puritanical, like, waspish country like the US. Like, you'd kind of imagine that having a big dumpy wouldn't necessarily have the same tangible promise of economic mobility in the US as it does in Brazil, because the US is so, like, anti-sex. So why do you think that women in the US would be striving for a bum bum to a comparable degree as Brazilians? I can't say these things.
I think that it depends on the types of career paths we're considering, right? We're also, exactly, like, a lot of the girls we're seeing on King Street are with BBLs. I just automatically assume probably work in social media in some capacity as content creators. Or
how dare you? They can, a girl with a BBL can work in environmental policy.
Absolutely. But if we're thinking about, like, the investment.
No, I agree.
Of a BBL, I think there is a career-centered investment. It's just the types of careers have changed. I mean, again, it's like in the industries where it's always mattered how you look, then it helps. And then I also think it's perhaps tied to upward mobility, not necessarily in a career pathway, but more so in a dating way. It's like dating men with money. There's like a pragmatic reason beyond, like, yeah, I don't think having, like, a great ass is going to get you a job at, like, the bank.
Your middle school teacher is not going to get a BBL for obvious, like, cultural career reasons, but also because she literally can't afford it.
Yeah.
We need to, I think, create a society where middle school teachers can afford BBLs.
I mean, don't worry. I'm working on it. And I once I get it together and my campaign starts, it'll happen. But yeah, it's a different type of, like, upward mobility, I suppose. People have been getting plastic surgery for years. I mean, yes, it's to, like, look nice, but it's also to benefit from those nice looks.
Definitely. And we talked a lot in our Sex and the Internet season about the way that social media has created something of, like, a gig economy for online sex workers, in the sense that they can create something of a small business for themselves via OnlyFans and other platforms like that. So I've said this before, but I think the US is extremely perverse when it comes to sexuality, in the sense that it both, like, demonizes it and suppresses it, but also is as hypersexual as you can get in this distorted way, so long as that sexuality is profitable. And I think, like, you know, Instagram offers women a lot of opportunities just by virtue of their looks. So we see this whole industry pop up of women getting major brand deals because they become influencers for posting hot photos. And that would include a hypersexual big booty.
Exactly. Yeah. I also think that America is drawn to, like, and I'm not saying that people with BBLs look like freaks, but I think that this sort of, like, uncanny, almost trick mirror-ish kind of way that they look is, there's, America loves an almost like a spectacle or like a freak show. And I think that there's, like, something about seeing something that almost looks normal but is slightly off that does sort of attract people. It's like your eyes are sort of drawn to it. And I think people want to be shocked. They like hearing that someone obtained this through, like, a shocking and, for some people, like, morally dubious manner. And I think that it's one of the few ways that you can express sexuality in the States, is if it's somewhat, not grotesque, because I'm not calling a BBL grotesque, but if it's, like,
it is kind of grotesque. That's okay. Like, it is.
If it's something
you're literally like sucking like fat out of another part of your body in this like bloody dangerous procedure and shooting it into your ass and like maybe dying. It is grotesque.
I think that a lot of like North America wants things to be packaged up in these ways for ultimate entertainment value. And I think even just the story of BBL is more like interesting to us than like,
well, yeah, it's a very go big or go home kind of place, America. I do think it's a country that celebrates, like you're saying, artifice and extremity. There was a time that Pam Anderson's insane fake tits, which they were so scary looking. They looked like they were about to pop, were considered a sort of beauty standard on their own. And I just think we're seeing that kind of go in the other direction with the BBL, totally. I also think, I don't know, there's such a sort of cartoonishness, uncanniness, like you're saying, to the BBL that makes it look like you kind of jumped out of a funhouse mirror. If you were to stand in one of those, your butt would kind of shoot out in this funny direction. And I think that this bodes well for influencers in the sense that the more extreme you can go in their mind, the more money you make because you're standing out, because you're playing to that freak show voyeurism that the US is so known for. That kind of like Maury Povich, like
exactly
TLC type of America. So it creates a sort of like funhouse mirror effect when regular women are looking at these extremes and turning dysmorphically inwards on themselves and being like, why doesn't my body look like that? And then it's just kind of like this trickle effect.
You forget that like that's not how almost anybody looks, even people with naturally large asses. Like that's just not what a body looks like.
No. Well, again, you would have thighs, you would have cellulite, you'd have all these things.
But you see it enough and your brain forgets because your brain has seen it so many times. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. The BBL hashtag on TikTok. TikTok. The BBL
TikTok. TikTok.
The BBL
sorry.
TikTok. The BBL hashtag on TikTok as of 2021 had 3.9 billion views. There were tons of women on the app documenting their BBL journeys and talking about how their BBLs changed their lives and made their dreams come true, and how like it not only enhanced their asses but also snatched their waists, because again, it was taking this kind of hourglass figure and making it extreme, literally taking the fat out of your stomach. There was also this influencer named Anthony Bumba who made these videos that I love, where they parody like a Kylie Jenner-esque character called Miss BBL in different social situations, like the one where she eats with finger hooked over her mouth. Do you remember those at all?
Yes, I actually do remember. Yes,
but like we talked about in the Kim K episode, the big booty has allegedly come to an end, although Vogue has been smart enough not to call it this time. But yeah, there's a lot more information about the potential dangers of the luteal fat graft procedure, even though there's been quite a bit of innovation and regulation in the past few years that have made it safer than it was at its peak. Even though Anthony Bumba is generally friendly in their satirizing of the BBL, those videos were a part of a broader wave of anti-BBL discourse and like talks about the types of people who get BBLs, the King Street girlies. There was discussion about BBL fashion, like that Fashion Nova stretchy synthetic cutout bodycon aesthetic that dominated the late 2010s that I'm personally so glad to see go. It was just exhausting. In 2021, there was also this viral video of a flight to Atlanta that was delayed for 2 hours because 24 black women were boarding the plane in wheelchairs after all flying to the Caribbean to get BBLs. I think that's pretty iconic, personally. We'll post the video on Instagram. It's honestly so great. I love it. We've talked extensively about this bodacious trend going out of fashion and like skinny coming back in and the ways that black traits that were co-opted are now being discarded. So we won't go too deep into that, but I will say that it was interesting to learn in researching for this episode just how directly racist the origins of the BBL really were. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear a lot about people cherry picking different traits from different ethnicities, but it's crazy that there was a time where like a government was actually propagating this. I was reading one article which questions whether the BBL era has finally come to an end, and it interviews this person who runs a TikTok account called Kardashian Colloquium that takes an academic approach to the Kardashians. And they have this quote where they say, "We don't know yet if it really is the end. We don't have enough data yet, but the Kardashians are aging and will commodify themselves in different ways." And then the article points out that like even super influencers remain vulnerable to patriarchal ideas of female expiration dates, which like I'm not out here feeling bad for the Kardashians, but I honestly haven't heard this hypothesis brought up in conversation with this end of the booty income skinny trend. And I wanted to know what you thought about that, like this kind of variable of age as it relates to body trends shifting.
The way I always viewed like the Kardashians suddenly like getting rid of the BBL was just that, like you've kind of outlined, the BBL became safer, became maybe a bit more widespread, more accessible. It just became so popular that the thing that made them famous, that made them stand out when they have almost nothing else to offer, just became too mainstream. There were so many clones of them that I think they probably went into an image management crisis mode and were like, well, what can we do to differentiate Kim from the 50 billion girls who now could be her identical twin? And they're like, well, let's just get rid of the trait that has made her so iconically her. Not to say she doesn't still have an ass, but like, let's take away the bodacious. Let's do this thing. And probably also, I'm sure someone predicted that inevitably, once things got so bodacious centric, things would just inevitably go back to hyper skinny. There was the 20-year trend cycle, all of that. That like,
what about the idea of like age itself, more specifically? Because we've talked a lot about the idea of like skinny coming back in, but
yeah, I think the Kardashians, it's hard because like, look at Kris Jenner. That bitch just got a new face.
It's true. It's true. But I wonder if extremeness or cartoonishness holds up. I don't know if the older you get, you can be keeping up with these trends, keeping up with the Kardashians. But like, I just think that there's been very little talk about the longevity of these types of procedures, physical longevity, until the Kardashians started getting them reversed. It does make me wonder whether influencers like the Kardashians will start going down like the Gwyneth Paltrow like wellness route as they get older, because it's seen to be more sustainable, both like health-wise and aesthetically and economically. It's just the idea that you can age out of a beauty standard, I think, is kind of fascinating. Obviously, women who just naturally have those features will just have those features. But the BBL is so invasive and so aggressive a procedure that it's just like, oh, yeah, older women can't really sustain, you know, the booty. It also just maybe like isn't associated with older women like having a booty.
Sure.
Because you lose muscle mass, you lose all the stuff as you get older. So I just wonder if they're like trying to switch that up. For longevity purposes, yeah. I guess.
I definitely think that their public image's general like aesthetic has like changed in such a way where like, yeah, maybe, okay, let's say Kim wants to be considered like a serious CEO. We were saying, like, I don't necessarily know how important the BBL is in that and perhaps does less for her position in the business world. I definitely like, I mean, Kourtney Kardashian is so goop coated that she even tried to make her own goop knockoff.
Literally.
Poosh. I think also like you can see on the Kardashians them adopting a bit more of like a 90s minimalist aesthetic. I think, yes, perhaps there's a youthfulness that they were associating with those body types. And realistically, Kim Kardashian, her body is going to age in some capacity, whether she likes it or not. And like, you know, considering how vain she is, I'm sure we'll reach a place where she is less interested in showing it off to the extent that she historically has as it looks older. And then at that point, what's the point in having this almost like sculpture-esque figure, right? If your priorities aren't necessarily in like showing it off. That being said, maybe she'll surprise me and maybe she'll be, you know, posing naked until like her skin is completely sagging, and then, you know, maybe that would actually do some good for the world, or at least, you know.
I guess, except Kris Jenner isn't.
Acceptance of, you know. Yeah. But I think realistically, probably not. Yeah. I think that, like, they stopped wanting to traffic in the currency of shock value and started actually wanting to be taken seriously as entrepreneurs. And I think that once their priority stopped being aligned with leaning into this, like, more freak show side of things. Even you can see on the progression of the show, like it used to be them doing crazy stuff and having big personalities, and now it's just them like sitting around and having really mundane conversations. And I think part of that is them kind of becoming more boring and having higher stakes in like having some sort of degree of reputable.
Yeah, because they're business owners. Yeah, exactly. And I think like, I don't know, yeah, even just thinking about the BBL as being this emblem of fertility, like fertility is a young person's game.
Yeah, they're for moms the most part now. They're all moms
for the most, yeah, they've already given birth, they've already done that, and so it's kind of like
they also like be using surrogates.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, and then extending outside of the Kardashians, I don't know, it's just interesting that plastic surgery was something that once belonged to older women as a form of anti-aging is now thought of like we're talking about as a young person's game, that young people are now dominating the plastic surgery zeitgeist. I just found that kind of fascinating, but I can't say I'm sad to see the BBL go. I'm definitely down for it to make an out. Am I sad to see that like curvaceousness is going yes, but like also once again, when we can just say this a million times over, but just, you know, bodies aren't trends, blah blah blah, we all know this.
I think that plastic surgery has, I think, just, I mean, we're going to talk about this, maybe we'll tease the next episode, is like, we will be talking a bit more about the like almost mundane nature of plastic surgery today and how it's no longer taboo, it's no longer shocking, and because of, you know, technological advancements, it is becoming affordable to the point that, yeah, I think it used to be mostly associated with older people because older people also had money.
Yeah.
Like, yes, it's an anti-aging thing, but it's also a, I have the money to spend on this. Now younger people are able to put some of these procedures more into their, like, budget range. And I think that that, like, makes a big difference about who's doing it too. It's like, you don't necessarily have to, like, wait till you've married to, like, a rich husband in order. You can girl boss your way into a BBL.
R.I.P. Karl Marx, you would have loved the BBL.